This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.
The following podcast is scheduled for one fall, and there will be no disqualification. Making their way to the ring from lineupmedia.fm at a combined weight of 849 pounds, the Three Horsemen.
That's right, we are back with you. The Three Horsemen, Corey, T.O., and Big E are here with you today. Boys, what's going on?
Not much at all.
Same as every other day, except today, I'm proud to be talking wrestling.
Crazy Peanut Gallery in here. We're coming to you from the snowy, cold St. Louis, Missouri area. And today, we've got a special guest with us joining for the first half of the show. From Lineup MMA, we've got Sean Wheelock. Sean, how you doing?
Very good. I can't stay off the network. Thanks for having me on the program.
Glad to have you.
Sean has a background. Sean is from Kansas City. Now, you're on the Kansas side.
Absolutely.
Shawnee, I'm on the Kansas
side. Shawnee, Kansas, and proud member of the Kansas Athletic Commission.
Beautiful. Give everyone a taste of what you grew up with wrestling-wise.
So I grew up in a suburb, an outer suburb of Kansas City called Shawnee, Kansas, and that was about, 15, 20-minute drive west of Kansas City, Kansas. Kansas City, Kansas proudly contains the Great Memorial Hall, and every Thursday night, including Thanksgiving night, which was always a big show, every Thursday night during my childhood, there was Central States Wrestling, All-Star Wrestling, and that was the great promotion, part of the NWA, that was co-owned by Bob Geigel, Harley Race, and Pat O'Connor. And Bob Geigel was multiple-time president of the NWA. Harley Race and Pat O'Connor, both multiple world champions in the NWA. And it was a phenomenal promotion. I caught at the cusp of when Vince McMahon Jr. was just starting to expand, and he had taken his father's then WWWF to the WWF, and this is before WWE days.
Right.
So this is as Vince McMahon was starting to expand, starting to do what was just unthinkable in professional wrestling in that era, which was to go into another promoter's territory, but he did it. And I remember also simultaneously going to shows at Kemper Arena, which were the big WWF shows. And as a kid, I just wanted to see wrestling. I was a huge mark. I didn't care. But my main loyalty was to those Thursday night shows at the Great Memorial Hall in Kansas City, Kansas. And it was phenomenal. And the names of the era that would come through, aside from the Central States wrestlers who we had, like Bruiser Bob Sweetan, Rufus R. Jones, Bulldog Bob Brown, we had the Midnight Express. But then we also had a lot of the big NWA stars. So Dusty Rhodes would come through, and Ted DiBiase, before he was the Million Dollar Man, when he was actually a face, when he was a good guy, a fan favorite. Buzz Sawyer, Wildfire Tommy Rich, the Von Erichs would come up from Texas. It was really a phenomenal time to be a very young wrestling fan.
That's good stuff. And in fact, you mentioned Bob Geigel. They just put some old footage of Bob Geigel up on WWE Network. In fact, but we've also talked to you before in another incarnation of this show. You were there for the Dusty Rhodes Ric Flair title switch.
Yeah, I was actually, and I do have a memory of it. I was a really little kid. I was in early grade school. And I remember that we were seated on the floor. You could never get in the first two rows because those were the people that literally went every Thursday, and they had probably done so since like 1948. But you could usually get in the fourth or the fifth row on the floor seating. But Memorial Hall, I've also refereed boxing in that building. I've commentated MMA. The first MMA I ever commentated was in that building. Obviously a huge thrill to be back there. But it's a lot like the Blue Horizon in Philadelphia. It wasn't built for fighting, but it might as well have been built for fighting, because there was literally, and it's of course a cliche, but there's not a bad seat in the house. But you could get floor seats, and oftentimes Bob Geigel would answer the phone personally when you called the box office,
wow,
which was cool. And And so I was on the floor. I don't know exactly. This is a long time ago now, but I was a very little kid, but I was in probably the third or fourth or fifth row. I know I was with my friend Justin Kerr and my dad, and it was Harley Race, or I beg your pardon, it was Dusty Rhodes who came in as the NWA World Champion.
Right.
Against Ric Flair. Neither were territorial wrestlers, but it was brought in because of Bob Geigel and Harley Race and Pat O'Connor, so they would get world title fights. And you have to think of the era. This was either 81 or 82, and I should know, and I don't.
It's 81, you're good.
81, okay. And this was not on live TV. This was recorded, and then it was played on the Sunday on the old Channel 41 when it was a UHF independent, and that was as a one-hour cut-down show from 9 to 10 a.m. But this wasn't on live TV, so you think how much the wrestling business has changed from essentially 35 years ago. So Ric Flair, a lot of heat on him, obviously, and he came in sort of as a heel, but not totally as a heel. He had his fans. Dusty Rhodes was definitely a face as a champion. Everyone loved the American Dream, and it was a great match and back and forth. And it was the first time that Ric Flair was put over, and Dusty Rhodes allowed to take the fall and allowed to put Flair and put Flair over. He was obviously ordered to, but put Flair over. And the first time that Ric Flair claimed the NWA World Heavyweight title, I was there. And my memory is Dusty Rhodes went out and he limped right past me, this great look of anguish on his face. And I thought, man, this stuff is so real. He's really hurt. He was probably disappointed they made him give up the strap.
That's gold. And such a strange match. In fact, Lou Thesz refereed that match, and it's just when you hear Flair talk about it, it's odd that it took place in Kansas City, but there had been a previous title change in Kansas City. But it's just a strange thing. But I imagine they say Geigel had a hand in that, and that does not surprise me. They were pretty good at getting what they wanted, but we're talking breaking kayfabe, basically getting out of the realm of keeping us all in, you know, in carny terms, kayfabe. But have you had any instances over the years? I mean, I don't know how much you've kept up with wrestling. You haven't had any instances that come to mind in terms of breaking kayfabe?
Yeah, my knowledge of wrestling is really in the 80s and the 90s, and I'm still Beautiful. A fan. I'm not a mark anymore, but I was definitely a mark as a kid in the 80s and the 90s. And kayfabe, my best definition of it, is the full illusion in and out of the ring, in and out of the arena, every day of your life, that professional wrestling is real. So much so that if you're in a feud with someone, even if they're your best friend in real life, you don't travel in the same car.
Exactly.
You don't go out for drinks. You don't have dinner together. You know, there are legendary stories about fighters who are meant to be in feuds, and fans will spot them, and they're all out with their wives and having dinner, and they'll be fired from that promotion. You mm-hmm. did not break it. If you're a heel and say you're doing your grocery shopping and a fan comes up to you, you're supposed to be a heel to that fan. You just don't break character.
I still
you
wish it was that way.
Do not. It was great. And you just do not break character. And so kayfabe was real. I mean, it really existed. It was a code of honor. And what I knew, and when I wrote with Art Davey, the founder of the UFC, his book, we did a lot of research on when it went from sports to sports entertainment. Mm-hmm. And something I knew about, and I researched it a lot for the book, because as a side story, we talked about athletic commissions and regulations. The end of kayfabe, really, and I think it's pretty much gone. There's still some true believers, but
right.
No one is keeping up the kayfabe illusion anymore, at least not in North American professional wrestling.
No.
Is that Vince McMahon did not want to pay his sanctioning fee to the New York State Athletic Commission.
Exactly right.
And the New York State Athletic Commission, right, was putting a heavy tax on it. And you see that in – I'm on the Kansas Athletic Commission. I'm not paid, but we put a 5% gate fee on. And for MMA and for boxing, kickboxing, Muay Thai, and Vince McMahon didn't want to pay that. So he said to them, look, guys, this isn't sports. And I don't know if he coined the term sports entertainment, but he certainly popularized the term sports entertainment, saying – we don't need to be regulated by an athletic commission because we're not really an athletic event. And that was the end of kayfabe. But it was serious business. And I would think most wrestlers under the age of 30, they know about kayfabe, but they're not expected to maintain that. maybe in the arena, but they're not expected to maintain that when they're out shopping, for instance, when they're down the aisles at Target, they're not meant to be in character.
No,
but that was certainly the case, really, up through, I would say, in a lot of promotions, the late 80s, early 1990s, you did not break character, did not break kayfabe. I did have an experience, though, where Ox Baker, and he came into the Central States. I'd never seen him wrestle, and truthfully, I only knew him as a little kid from Escape from New York because he plays a great character. Mm-hmm. He's the one that Kurt Russell, I believe he spikes in the back of the head with the club in Escape from New York.
Right, in the wrestling match.
Yeah,
in
exactly.
A ring anyway, yeah.
And I knew as a little kid where the wrestlers parked, and you would hang out there and get autographs. And Ox Baker comes, and he was huge, and he had the long mustache, and he was meant to be there as a heel. And he was so kind and sweet to me, and he actually broke kayfabe for the 6 or 7 year old me, and that made a lasting impression. But by and large, if you were a heel, you're going to be very rude to the little kids asking autographs. But that was nice to see Ox Baker stepping out and actually being a real guy. And probably once he was in Escape from New York, he knew he had to be a little nicer to his fans. He couldn't be a heel all the time.
Very true. And you bring up the changeover to sports entertainment. And it's funny because that happened around 88, 89. And the year or two before that, Jim Duggan and Iron Sheik were arrested on the New Jersey Turnpike together.
I remember that.
And were jailed on drug charges. And that cost Duggan and Sheik their jobs. And then a year or two later, obviously Duggan had been brought back in after being told he'd never work there again. And then all of a sudden, it's all good.
And yeah, it's amazing. And I think they lost their jobs not because of the drug charges, but because they broke kayfabe.
Because they were in the car together.
Yeah. that was the bigger issue.
Yeah, as we learned from Jimmy Snuka, it took a lot more than that to lose your job.
yeah.
Well, I'm just saying.
That's true, but...
And we've got a ton of instances that we're gonna talk about. I know your time is limited, but we're gonna be talking about some other things. And there's a guy that he broke kayfabe more than once. In fact, there's an interview that circulates around YouTube with Bruiser Brody, and he just talked about the business at length. But I would imagine you saw a good amount of Bruiser Brody in Kansas City.
Yeah, he came through the territory all the time. He wasn't a quote-unquote Central States wrestler or house wrestler,
right,
like a Bulldog Bob Brown was, or a Mike George, for instance, or Omar Atlas. But he would come through multiple times. And we would see that with Andre the Giant, who, as I said earlier, Tommy Wildfire Rich. There were fighters that were on the circuit. Some would come up on loan, like Tommy Wildfire Rich would come up from Georgia Championship Wrestling. But some were just revolving players in the NWA. Andre the Giant would be the most notable. Certainly Bruiser Brody falls into that category. I'm obsessed with kayfabe, and I'm even more obsessed with shoots and works. And for the uninitiated, a shoot is a fight that's real, and a work is a fight when both fighters are in on predetermining the outcome. And we always talk about on my program, Lineup MMA, when people say, oh, this fight was fixed, and I very nerdily explain the difference between a fix and a work. And a work comes right out of pro wrestling. A work is a predetermined outcome when both fighters are in on it. A fix is a predetermined outcome when both fighters are not in on it. So when fans cry fix, what they really mean is it was worked. When they talked about Kimbo Slice versus Ken Shamrock, when they were talking about Chael Sonnen versus Tito Ortiz, they're saying fix, they mean work. They're saying both are conspiring. But the opposite of the work, and you see it really never in wrestling now, but you used to see it a lot, especially in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and even through the 1980s and early 1990s, were shoots when, for whatever reason, professional wrestling turned real. And Bruiser Brody, it's on YouTube, it's on Daily Motion, a very famous shoot with Lex Luger. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, it's coming up
in a cage match. And Bruiser Brody must have just been in a bad mood, and he pummels Lex Luger, and it's really a merciless beating.
So you've watched that?
About 1,000 times.
Okay.
I'm obsessed with shoots and works.
And it's an odd thing because Bill Alfonso's the referee, and he tells the story, and Brody just essentially stops working, and Luger's punching him, and he's just standing in the corner. Luger just climbs the ropes, climbs the cage, and walks home.
Just leaves. That's it. I'm done.
I mean, I can't imagine. I can't imagine what anybody would have been thinking had they seen it.
Right. There's the great kayfabe term, because kayfabe has its own vocabulary, and anyone who's listening to this knows me from my MMA commentary. I usually will work in some kayfabe terms. I'll say squash, which is in MMA we call that a non-competitive match as a squash, but a squash match in professional wrestling, when you would see a big name wrestler against a guy who you knew had no chance. That's in industry terms, in kayfabe that's a squash. But I also like the kayfabe term working stiff, or being a stiff worker. And that means that, yeah, it's still a work and it's a predetermined outcome, but you're going to put some punishment on your opponent. You're really going to throw that chop into the chest. You're really going to turn over that kick into the thigh.
Or make them have a hard time giving you the body slam.
Exactly, yeah, and that's called working stiff or being a stiff worker. So I think initially, maybe even the fans, the smarks, right, the smart marks, watching that were like, yeah, Brody's just a stiff worker. And I'm sure Luger was thinking that, and then he realized, no, he's not working at all. This is not going to turn out well for me. I think I'll just leave.
So if you're watching or keeping up with the business leads into the 90s, you've got to have some type of view or thought on the Montreal Screwjob.
Yeah, and it goes back and forth, and it's like it's a work, but it's a shoot, but it's a shoot disguised as a work, disguised as a shoot, disguised as a work. Yeah, it's really amazing. And just when you think that there's the definitive story on that match, then you'll hear some counter evidence. But
it's because really the ego's involved.
Right. It really harkens back to 1930s and 40s professional wrestling, where the champion goes in, and usually in that era, the title matches were best 2 out of 3 falls. So it's worked, it's scripted, it's predetermined that the champion and the challenger are going to split the first two falls. And the historical precedent for the Montreal Screwjob is the local fighter, the challenger, who's the big star in that regional promotion or that city promotion, will somehow win the third fall, even though he wasn't supposed to, and take the title. And there's a lot of that through the 30s and 40s, even into the 1950s. And that's why you talked about Lou Thesz earlier. Guys like Lou Thesz, guys like Bob Geigel, Vern Gagne would have been an example of that. Danny Hodge is a great example of that. They really knew how to shoot. That if it went down where they thought a double cross was coming, that they weren't going to be able to win the third fall and retain the title, someone was going to take their belt from them and their security deposit that went with that belt of $10,000, that they really better know how to fight. They really better know how to turn over punches and kicks and really know submissions and submission defense. And you had some crazy stories from that era. And if you go back even further, like Ed Strangler Lewis and Farmer Burns, fighters who really knew how to fight. They were wrestlers, but they were really fighters when they had to be.
I actually met someone who received swimming lessons from Ed Strangler Lewis.
That's insane.
In St. Louis. I mean, just because I told him, I said, yeah, you know, I'm a wrestling fan. And I said, you know, we had, where I was working previously, they had a night where we honored wrestling at the Chase, and we had Harley Race, Greg Valentine, Jerry Briscoe, Bob Orton, Baron Von Raschke. They came in and were, you know, conversing with people, and it was, you know, they all shared memories. They had a blast just talking to people about their experience watching them.
Yeah, that's such a great era. And so many of those names that you mentioned, again, were legitimate tough guys. Harley Race, who's one of my boyhood heroes, people talk about all the time. If Harley Race, were 25 or even 35 years old, that he would be an MMA.
MMA.
He would be really good in MMA. That these were guys who, yeah, they're going to put you over. They're going to be total professionals, but best not to cross them. And then so many of the wrestlers, I talked about Vern Gagne, Danny Hodge, coming out of really storied NCAA Division I wrestling careers. So they had that. And then if you talk about fighters who actually knew real submissions like Judo Gene LaBelle and Lou Thesz, it's a potent combination. It wasn't MMA, but there was the ingredients there to be MMA. For the most part, these guys know it's like stuntmen. You don't want to hurt your colleague, and it's two-way traffic. You can hurt them. They can hurt you. Everyone's trying to make a living. But obviously, there are personalities that clash and tempers flare, and you hear these stories. I did boxing in the early 2000s. So the early part of last decade was Scott Ledoux. Scott Ledoux and I, when Friday Night Fights was doing close to 50 shows a year, it was Bob Poppin and Teddy Atlas was the number one team. And the fill-in team, when we didn't get many fill-ins, but when we did a few a year, was Scott Ledoux and me. And Scott Ledoux, he since passed away, he was a great man. And he had been top 10 in the world as a heavyweight boxer. And when his boxing career was over, his wife passed away. He's a single father. He needs to make a living. So he turns into pro wrestling. He's in Minnesota. Yeah. Vern Gagne brings him in. So Scott Ledoux tells me this story. And his wrestling stories were much better than his boxing stories. And his boxing stories were great. Tells me the story where he's meant to have a feud with One Man Gang. Do you remember One Man Gang?
Absolutely. Of course.
Massive guy, probably 400 pounds, right? Huge guy. So Scott Ledoux, in his match, which has obviously worked, he's meant to throw the big knockout punch. That's his finishing move. Makes sense. He was a former top 10 in the world, legitimate heavyweight boxer, fought George Foreman. So he throws it, turns over the right hand, quote-unquote, knocks One Man Gang unconscious, pins him. One Man Gang, in kayfabe terms, doesn't sell it. As soon as the bell rings, he gets up, walks back. So a couple of nights later, same match, same predetermined outcome.
Yeah, Scott Ledoux,
yeah, exactly, turns over the right hand, legitimately knocks out One Man Gang. And in Scott Ledoux's telling to me, One Man Gang is unconscious for like 20 minutes, which knowing Scott Ledoux and seeing how big his hands were, I could believe that. But that stuff happened. It doesn't really happen now, but that stuff happened then. Scott Ledoux is one of the nicest people I ever met, but he was professionally embarrassed, and he was going to teach One Man Gang a lesson.
That'll do it.
Wow. I had never – I have heard – I feel like I've heard every wrestling story in history. I have never heard that.
Did you know when he woke up from that, he actually thought his name was Akeem, and that's the rest of his
story? Oh, the dream.
That's right.
Akeem the dream. No, man, and see, you bring up Danny Hodge. I brought him up on the show last week, and I know you got to go. Go ahead, plug away. What do we got
you,
to listen?
You can finish your Danny Hodge story. That's okay.
Oh, we were just talking about Danny Hodge last week, and I was telling the guys, they say, you know, Jim Ross tells the story that he would take him around the territory, and he'd walk into a hardware store and break pliers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, just incredibly strong human being. Broke his neck in a car crash, climbing out of the car, submerged in water, breaks the glass, and climbs out of his car.
Jeez.
Freak.
Famous for taking an apple, even still, taking an apple and crushing it in his hand.
Incredible.
The great Danny Hodge. This has been a blast. I'm happy to talk wrestling with you guys anytime. And my show on the network is lineupmma.com, which I do with Joe Warren and Ben Askren, two of the top MMA fighters in the world, both world champions in wrestling. Joe Warren and Greco-Roman, Ben Askren in freestyle. Ben Askren from the University of Missouri, by the way.
Yes. Hey, real quick, Sean, I know you got to go. I want to ask one quick question because we're all in the same boat. We don't watch the product now. We follow it, read about it. Is there anything that could happen right now in wrestling to get you back involved as a fan?
Yeah, if they would go more to when it was submission based, and when I see a little bit of the Japanese stuff, I like it because I grapple. I'm a huge submission fan, and part of what's fun for me when I go online and I'll watch matches from the 30s, which you can find online, and certainly from the 70s and the 80s, you see the genesis of submission grappling in there. So you see a figure four leg lock, which, by the way, I've tried at my grappling gym, doesn't work. But you could turn that into a knee bar. It comes from something. You know, a surfboard doesn't work, but you can definitely take
the
back of an opponent. Yeah, absolutely. In Indian deathlock, if it's put on, it can be a calf slicer. It can work. A rear naked choke, that was a sleeper hold when we were all kids. Kimura, that was a hammer lock when we were all kids. So if it went a little more submission-based, but I'll leave you guys with this. So about 3 weeks ago, In my state of Kansas, we had a WWE show, what's called a house show. It wasn't televised.
Sure.
At the Kansas Expo Center in Topeka. So they were nice enough to give our executive director of the state, Adam Rohrbach, and myself tickets, second row ringside. It was great. And I watched and I had a lot of fun, but it just didn't suck me in the way it used to. And it's just, and this is not a knock on the product, and I understand people love it and fair enough, but it's so much about selling the storylines. And I just don't feel that it was as much of the storylines. It was more about the wrestling, and that's what's not turned me off, because I'm not turned off to it. That's what's failed to hold my interest. If it went more to where it was more competitive and they're throwing on submissions, and I know it's worked, but to see more of the athleticism and more of the genesis of catch wrestling,
and I think MMA that would bring me in more. MMA has hurt that, because people that watch UFC and the MMA see these different submission holds and know what it takes now and what these holds do, and they don't translate into WWE to where they know these, you know, they're educated about these holds.
Right, you should be able to put
no question about it. No question about it. You know, when The Undertaker is doing his finish, which in MMA and in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, it's called a go-go plata, and you really know how to put on a go-go plata, which happily I do, and then you see that, you're like, it's just not quite working for me. But, you know, some of the Japanese stuff, like with Jim Ross and Josh Barnett, commentate is fun, but I don't get Access TV on my cable system, so I have to pull that online. But that stuff that appeals to me.
Cool.
Great stuff, man. Sean, can't thank you enough for being on the show. We're going to try and steal you again here in the near future.
My pleasure. Anytime. Thank you so much for having
me. Take
it
easy, Sean.
See you, Sean, man. We'll catch up soon.
See you guys. Thank you. Take care.
See ya. Sean Wheelock from Lineup MMA. All Dude's I can say is that guy knows his stuff.
He's legit.
I love it.
He's looking to do another cast. I think we could become the Four Horsemen quite easily.
Yeah, I don't think it would be.
Fucking become Two Horsemen.
Pretty much. I'll just watch.
Well, I mean, it's good stuff, man. He brings up Danny Hodge. He brings up. Jeez.
That's an intimate knowledge. That's not like a passive fan. The guy knows his shit. So.
Well, he's done research, and, you know, he talks about that, and we're going to get into this, breaking kayfabe. But again, that was Sean Wheelock from Lineup MMA with Joe Warren, Ben Askren. It's a great show, am I right?
It's pretty damn good.
Yep.
Great show.
If you're in the MMA and you want to inside, you know, look at what's going on by, through fighters and people who have been backstage and know the business, you can't get a better podcast than that.
No. Again, that was good times. Let's get into this, boys. Let's talk breaking kayfabe. I mean, where do we start? Where do we finish? First, we got to start it. We started pretty well there.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, that was kind of.
Let's just start hitting examples.
Kind of had it.
I mean,
The first thing that I have my first thoughts, but you guys tell me, talk to me. What's breaking kayfabe to you guys?
Well, one of the most famous examples is the curtain call. I always think of that one. That wasn't on camera, so to speak, but it cost a couple of the guys who stuck with the company. If you want to give the story, it cost them pretty dearly.
Yeah. So so many people know the story of the curtain. If you're listening to a wrestling podcast,
yeah, you likely
you
know about
know.
That. But
I always wonder what happened to where they just, did they like mumble to McMahon saying, hey, you know, we're going to have, you know, a handshake at the end. We're going to hug. Did he know as
that's the big
Scott Hall and Paul Levesque walk past him? Triple H, as they walk past him, is it like, what the fuck are these guys doing?
What's funny is that the Triple H ate shit for it. You know, he
took it worse, apparently.
He was the one that got hammered for it. And
deserved
then,
it.
But didn't that really, like, jumpstart The Rock?
It was like because they weren't pushing him, they were pushing The Rock.
Yeah, someone got a huge push because Triple
Steve
H.
Austin.
It was Austin. Yeah, Austin, not The Rock.
Triple H was scheduled to win the King of the Ring in 96.
Yep, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And instead, they put in Austin. Austin catches fire.
Well, that's the famous 316. That's the famous 316.
Yeah.
I just whipped your ass or whatever. Yep. Yeah.
But it's not like Austin caught fire immediately. This is one of those revisionist history things.
And it's not like he wouldn't have caught fire anyway. I mean,
it would have been a lot tougher. Especially this is this is May of 96, I believe.
Yeah, anyway. King of the Ring was always a June, May, June pay-per-view.
So that's immediately done. Like, they switched it at the drop of a hat. But if I would have been a fan, I would have been, 14 at the time?
Mm.
I wasn't into wrestling at the time. So I don't know what I would have been like, what the fuck is going on? just an odd thing to do.
Yeah, why are they doing that?
Especially if the two bad guys, two good guys, I don't know.
It'd have been a head scratcher for sure, because at that time too, I was just starting to, you know, finally accept that wrestling wasn't, you know, 100% a legit thing. Mm-hmm. You know, 14 years old. Okay, I'm probably well past accepting it, but still.
I was going to say, when did you guys realize wrestling wasn't
right
real?
Around the time Santa Claus became fake.
It's kind of pre-internet, too. So, you know, the rumors, you know.
Very true.
We're spoiled by so much.
That's true.
We know everything.
Well, yeah, back in the day, you'd have to go to the grocery store and stand for half an hour at the magazine rack because you couldn't afford it. And yeah, they were the greatest. I was doing good wrestling times. Mags and music mags, the rock and roll mags.
Metal Edge.
Oh, yeah, of course, Metal Edge.
Hit Parader.
Yeah, buddy.
That's how I got into Kiss.
For real. I used to have all, because every month you get the posters out of those. I'd love it. I had Metal Edge posters all over my wall.
That's good. T.O.'s like, yeah, whatever.
What's a Metal Edge?
That is a great example of when they broke, and that pretty much broke the door down across the business.
That was one of the big ones, yep.
But people still bought into things. I mean, because you're talking 2 months later, a month later, Hogan goes out and turns heel. And people bought it, and everybody, and that got everybody back into wrestling. So it's not like that killed the business.
Was it that shortly there? I guess it would have been, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it happened because those guys were gone and on TV within
weeks.
Weeks.
It was just Scott Hall for the first 3 or 4 weeks, and then Kevin Nash comes at the Great American Bash, was it? Wasn't it the first time he showed up?
Hall showed up on Nitro. It was a couple weeks that Hall came out by himself and
got pulled out.
So it was about 3 weeks in that they were both on TV. But people still bought that, like,
oh, dude,
hotcakes.
See, even then, back in those days, that was another one of the ones I was like, God damn, this seemed real.
Absolutely.
They played it perfectly. You got to give, they deserved every penny they got for that.
I agree. T.O., breaking kayfabe.
Go.
That's the first thing that I think of, because it was the first time that it was really thrown in your face. And since has been documented and recognized by the company.
Too much.
I mean, like, they did a fucking DVD on it, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Well, those guys now are all considered legends of the sport.
Yeah. I mean,
Scott,
but you have all your videos. I mean, the fun videos are the ones to watch where someone gets pissed off in the ring and, you know, goes into the
sometimes
sack
they're
of
fun.
Potatoes.
Sometimes they're fucking scary.
Yeah,
that is true.
Was it Bob Holly? Was Lesnar and Holly fighting, and Holly went limp on Lesnar? Or who was that?
Yeah, they say he sandbagged him, but I mean, that's you're not really. I don't know.
Is
it's not breaking kayfabe, but there's just
Lesnar. I mean, that guy could pick you up even if you sandbag and launch it.
Yeah, but not when you think you're getting help. If you're going into 40%.
Exactly. If you're going to grab my wrists while I pull you up, that's one thing. If you're going to go dead weight, I mean, that's another. Holly even says he wasn't sandbagging. He just bad timing. And Lesnar was dangerous in the ring. He still is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for God's sake.
Yeah, well, see how many suplexes he throws on Goldberg.
Yeah, well.
Ooh, that's interesting. Because Goldberg can't take that
maybe
kind of beating.
Maybe one.
I don't know what's going to happen there.
I'll tell you exactly what's going to happen there.
Okay, tell us next episode.
I think it's obvious.
We got to concentrate. So the first thing kayfabe I think of is just because of the story behind it is the plane crash involving Ric Flair in 75. So Flair, David Crockett, Johnny Valentine, Bob Bruggers, Tim Woods. Woods and Bruggers are good guys at the time. Valentine and Woods, I hope my history's right on this, I think are feuding. They get in the plane crash. Woods walks out of the plane crash, the only one. Valentine's in a wheelchair the rest of his life. Flair broke his back, obviously came back, I think.
No.
If I can remember right, 75, I think he wrestled, you know, 30-something more years. But Tim Woods was Mr. Wrestling. Walked out, wrestled that night. If my memory serves me correctly, wrestled that night after a plane crash that afternoon, that morning.
How did he fit in the plane with balls that big?
With paws that big?
Balls.
Balls that big. It's like paws. He might have had big hands. Fuck, I don't know.
But what does that have to do with it?
My hands are huge.
They're huge.
No, but that's crazy, but if they would, and it got out in the papers, obviously it was covered in the Carolinas, but they said Tim Woods, so nobody knew. And in fact, I think that's not actually his name, but it was his wrestling name. But nobody knew. They're like, oh, well, and he wrestled under a mask anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I always thought that was just – that's how close to the vest they played it. I mean, they weren't fucking around in the 70s. Even in the 80s, they weren't. And up to a point through the 90s, they weren't. But the other one – and I think even Bill Burr has done some commentary for this one. The Great Antonio against Antonio –
this is a hard one to watch, man.
Is that not the sickest thing you've ever seen?
Just the ass beating of the real big dude?
Oh, my God.
Is that what it is?
He can't. I mean, you can almost say he had it coming, but that was a badass beating he took. So the story behind this one, the real quick story is, they're working a match over in Japan, and Antonio Inoki, if everybody knows about Japan, you don't get much bigger than him over there.
Fuck, he fought Ali.
I mean, there you go. Yeah. Case in point. So he's working a match with the Great Antonio, and if you don't know who that is, I don't blame you. Not a lot of people do. He's this
Canadian wrestler. He had wrestled there, and he was over on a tour. I don't know how he got over.
You know how the Japanese are with the big, fat Americans. They love them. Anyway, this guy's like a 500-pounder. He's not selling anything. He looks like a troll. He's got a Prince Valiant type of haircut.
Oh.
And Inoki's hitting him, you know, with your standard shots, slapping him in the chest real good, bouncing off the ropes, and Inoki just kind of bounces him off and hits his chest like, oh, I'm so strong. Like, it's like he's kind of working like he's a giant of some sort. Any which way, about a minute and a half into it, Inoki's had enough and just starts laying the stiffest shots you've ever seen.
Because people were laughing.
Yeah, he was quite pissed about that.
And you do not laugh in Japan, because that will get your ass
whooped.
It's
a question of honor. I don't think that should... lightly over there.
Yeah, it's not today where they want comedy in wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
It was, all right. Plus, it's his promotion. I mean, I get he's saving face, and he's going to put a beat down on the guy. But the story is that the Great Antonio ended up homeless, side of the road.
Not good after that, or?
Might have caused some damage by that. I mean, he's bloodied.
He was, his face was just a mess. Crimson mask, if you will. It looked like Ric Flair after any good match in the 80s.
I mean, they're trying to drag him out of the ring. How's good that luck. For you?
Good luck.
And Sean brought it up, Luger and Brody in the cage.
I wasn't aware of that
this?
One. No.
I have to see that one.
Well, you guys can look it up while I tell the story. It's Brody. I don't know if Brody's... because my
down
understanding,
in Florida, or,
yeah, it's down yeah. in Florida. He's working Texas at the time. Bill Alfonso tells the story on YouTube. You can look it up, obviously. But if you've never watched, Luger and Brody are working at first, and I think my take on it is Brody's hitting him, and Luger is not selling the way he needs to. Luger was green as grass at the time. I want to say this is 86, 87.
Yeah, he was all look at that point.
And Brody just, all of a sudden, just says, fuck it. I'm done.
Yep.
Not going to, and I'm sure Luger thought, I'm going to get the shit kicked out of me.
It's kind of the reputation there.
In front of 3,000 people, and that is not going to look good for the rest of my lifetime.
It's not going to vote, yeah, for my career.
No. And what, you guys can look it up, but
the biggest surprise that comes out of this for me, though, to interrupt you, is Bill Alfonso was a referee back then.
Oh, yeah.
Blows my mind. Anyway.
Yeah, I never saw any of his ECW. I've seen clips, but I don't know. I mean, he didn't. I don't know. Just such a loudmouth little fucker. You'd want to kill him. And I can understand that up on the East Coast. They wouldn't have been a big fan of his. But no, he tells great stories about that. Have you guys found it yet?
I'm in the middle of watching it right now. Yeah. Skipping through it, but they haven't got to the real stiff shit yet.
No, but they said they got back into the locker room, and Luger just said, what happened? Brody just said, just wasn't working. And I'm sure from Bruiser Brody, I don't know.
Wasn't feeling it, Lex.
Yeah, wasn't feeling
it. Do you question him anymore after that? I don't.
Well, you understand why they... I
get to a part to where he does a body slam, and it looks like he has trouble getting Luger up a little bit.
Yeah.
I've heard Elizabeth had trouble getting Luger up, too.
Like a suplex. And Brody stands up, goes over, and just kicks him in the side of the head hard. Does it again, fifth time, sixth time. He's walking a circle around him, kicking him in the head.
That was Brody's style.
No, but you can tell he's putting something into the kick. I mean, it's not just him dicking, you know, like.
I wouldn't blame him.
Yeah.
And like I said, Luger was green, and he's making him look bad. He's making Brody look bad, and that's not good. It's, I mean, you get hit. I always go back to watching Tough Enough WWE, and Triple H is in the ring with a guy, and he punches him, and he bounces off the ropes or just stands there, and he's like, when I hit you, you fall to the ground. It's like you need to, if you say sell it, which, you know, sell it like Ricky Morton, which we'll talk about next episode when we talk about the Rock and Roll Hall Express.
Wow, I like that.
Well, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Now, Rock and Roll Express and Luger,
the Rock and Roll Hall of Nash.
Luger's punched Brody like 12 times in a row. Brody's standing in the corner, did not sell one of the punches.
No.
Looks like he's bleeding, and the referee like stood between them and was just like,
wrestle.
Yeah.
He's telling him to wrestle. You guys got to do something.
Unreal.
Luger just tosses him, the ref.
Yeah, well, that's how he had to get out of it.
And he's like, oh, hey, look, there's a way out. I'll just climb over.
I've never seen anybody climb ropes or a cage faster. Because you know how they always do the slow climb?
Blip.
I know. You know, it's always the slow climb. It's a shorter cage.
Brody has him in an Armin guillotine, too, and was cranking down on his neck. Throws the ref. Luger says, fuck it, I'm getting out of here.
Yep.
So he must have had that choke cinched in to where Luger felt like he could.
He was in trouble?
Yeah, where he'd pass out in the ring.
I could understand that. That's Brody and Luger. I mean, and we've got others.
They raised Brody's hand after Luger climbed out of the ring.
Threw the ref down. That's disqualification.
Ah.
Can't do that, man.
See?
There you go.
This isn't the WWF where you could climb the cage and win. In the NWA, you had to beat him inside the cage.
Yeah, the cage is just there to keep you from running away. Not give you another way to win.
And you don't want anybody cheating and helping out your opponent.
Fair enough.
I mean, until they started throwing chairs over the cage and throwing phones over the cage and throwing knucks over the cage or through the cage.
Saying that reminds me of the time that, was it the Dudleys called for the chair in ECW? And then they got like every chair in the house.
Throw them all
that
in the ring. Yeah.
It was nuts. Anyway.
All right. I don't want to see.
We keep getting
tangential. You're close. Well, you're close. Yeah. It was Cactus Jack and Terry Funk that called for the chair.
Oh, that's what it was. Was it a match with the Dudleys, maybe? I got to feel that the Dudleys were involved.
I want to say Public Enemy. Could be wrong.
Yeah. I think it was Public Enemy.
Anyway, it's on YouTube out there, listeners, if you're curious, find it.
Oh, it's everywhere. Looking through other breaking kayfabe things that I'm trying to keep from the last few. We talked about the screw job. What are your guys' thoughts on the Montreal screw job?
Well, Beyond the Mat, there was a movie that covered it, right? Pretty much just almost exclusively all that movie covered.
Hitman Wrestling with Shadows.
Wrestling with Shadows, is that what it was?
Yes.
I've seen so many of those weird, dumb documentaries.
But what's crazy is they weren't shooting it because of that.
No.
They were just shooting, and that just happened, you know.
That or this is the biggest work of all time.
No fucking way. There are people in that business can't keep their fucking mouth
shut.
That's
fair, true. It's a book
deal.
They're
carnies. They'll do anything for fucking money. They'll go do a shoot interview for $500 and 12 oxycodone.
I mean,
so one of those assholes.
It could have been the best one of all time and fooled not just the fans. The people in the back could have been fooled just as well.
Now, see, that's a possibility. There's a lot of people, like, you listen to Cornette about it. Cornette says, doesn't he say he's in there taking a shit and Vince comes in bleeding or something? Or who was it?
Now,
or am I getting confused on that?
Cornette.
Cornette got the fuck out of there. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Who was in the bathroom? Jerry Lawler?
No, now that's the fight between Brett and Sean. Pat Patterson and Jerry Lawler are in there.
And someone...
they knocked the damn wall down.
Where was Cornette at, though, when a bunch of Shawn Michaels' hair got pulled out?
He's in the office with Vince.
Cornette grabbed
Sean walks in with a handful of hair and says, I'm not going to take the, or this is not a safe working environment for me.
Was it Bret Hart's hair?
No, it was his own fucking hair.
Oh.
Yeah, Bret Hart didn't have blonde hair.
And
there's that.
Cornette jokes that he took the hair and put it in a bag for his collectibles.
Still fucking got it, dude.
That's awesome.
Cornette's the shit.
That guy's great.
He says that guy's fucking
great. He's fucking hilarious.
On the screw job, I don't know that Vince McMahon would get punched in the face, walk out down the hall and be filmed, and then let that get out.
Yeah, you wouldn't think he would let it get out on something he didn't have a piece of.
Which he might have.
That's about the only way. If it's like a background thing where he's making money on it, or there's a way that it really benefits him and his business, I can see him being in on it.
But just to see him, okay, we talked about him tearing both quads.
That was a great
one too. Neck surgery. Things like that, he doesn't sell, but he gets hit by Bret Hart, and all of a sudden he's on Queer Street walking down the hall, And I just always thought, how does that get out? And you just say, here, take a shot.
Pretty much.
I don't know. I don't know what they say, but they say Shane McMahon watched it and saw his dad get knocked out. So it always maybe had an effect on him. But I just,
something Shane had been wanting to see for years.
Wouldn't surprise me.
I got one. What about the – it was early 90s ECW-WWF crossover where it's a big brawl in the ring between all the ECW guys and all the WWF guys. And JBL, Justin Hawk Bradshaw, whatever he's going by at the time, beats the living shit out of the Blue Meanie during the ruckus. Beats him bloody. He's got a giant gash under his eye for whatever reason. And to this day, he doesn't say he ever had anything against him. He just beat the shit out of him.
The thing is, because he's an ass.
He's a cocksucker, yeah.
I can't believe anything that ECW is involved with because that's what they got over with. So I could, I wouldn't doubt that the Meanie gashed himself open on purpose just to try to.
Look at this face. Have you seen? Look at this. Look at that gash under his eye.
When the blood is underneath the eyes, that is usually getting juiced the hard way.
Oh, yeah, cut under the eye. See, I didn't realize it was under
his. Cut under the eye, I'm pretty sure broke his nose.
Yeah, he's like.
That's a face vagina.
Usually when you're cut right there, that's your fracture on your orbital bone, too. That's a rough spot to get
jacked
in.
Oof.
Put many of men
that counts as breaking kayfabe, right? More or less. I mean, you go out there, that's not really the storyline to beat the shit out of that guy.
Yeah, you give up your body to somebody and they just beat the fuck out of you.
I think it's pretty much been confirmed that JBL is just a big punk douchebag. So.
I'll take him on right now. I don't care.
Asshole. Other things I've got. Do you guys remember Russo cutting that promo on Hogan at Bash at the Beach?
So that was a lot of people there's conflicting reports on what Hogan knew and didn't know and what Russo told different people.
I was gonna say the conflict is what fucking Russo says.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, he knew I was gonna do
that.
Because
he contradicted himself 30 fucking times.
Well, who goes out and says all that shit?
And who'd they put it on?
Jeff Jarrett. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, later that night,
he mentioned Jeff Jarrett in that rant. He says something along the lines of, people coming out here like Jeff Jarrett, work every night, blah, 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 do good for the boys in the back. I mean, he was a Jarrett sucker, but whatever.
Yeah. He's a fucking tool. I'm not a big Russo fan. I don't like the guy.
He's the man responsible for the Attitude Era, and you need to go down on him.
That he is not. Yeah, I've got Goldberg versus Regal. I don't know if you guys have watched that real close, where Regal got fired because of the match.
Yeah.
See, I actually
that was really stiff.
I listened to an interview with Regal after that. It was on, I forget whose podcast it was, but he was talking about he didn't get fired right after that. He worked for the company another 3 or so months. He says. That's Regal's words himself.
Regal was in the WWF not long after that.
We'd have to check the dates, but just going from what I heard him himself say on a podcast, he claims that was not the reason he was fired.
It certainly didn't help him.
It couldn't have helped.
Because they said go out and give him a competitive match. Man, he made fucking Goldberg work for everything.
Yep. He was pissed more or less because he didn't think Goldberg had put in his dues, paid the dues, which was a real big deal between.
He was right.
Not that he's right or wrong, but still, that's not the way you do it. When you're told to go out there and work a match, put a guy over, you go out there, you work a match, put the guy over. You don't.
Well, he eventually put him over.
Well, fair enough.
He didn't walk out of the ring or anything.
Wasn't for lack of trying.
He took a fucking stiff spear. Ooh, God, Goldberg when he used to spear people early on. Oh, yeah, when you see their head hit.
Well, he was still learning.
Oh, make it look real. I'm sure they told him.
He also killed Bret Hart's career, but that's a whole other.
That's true. Now I don't know if you guys remember this one. And T.O., I thought we talked about this not too long ago. Daniel Pewter and Kurt Angle.
Yes.
This was an awkward one.
Yeah, because he puts him in what's the lock?
A Kimura, wasn't it?
Yeah, he had him in a Kimura.
It's a Kimura,
which
lock
is
on
more
your,
or less
like an arm.
A locked in. Yeah. Well, it's a hammer lock where you've got your arm locked in. So if I grab you, start putting you in the hammer lock, I hold you up with this hand and come around and lock it in like this, so there's no way you're getting out of it.
Ooh. Well, he locked him in, that son of a bitch, and Angle took him to the
only
ground.
Way Angle was getting out of it is to force a pin.
Well, he didn't even force a pin. They just pinned him on the referee just said, fuck it.
Yeah, exactly. The ref knew what Angle was trying to do is basically stop this shit to get out of that move.
Oof.
Pooter thought he was going to be a badass since he had an MMA background.
Yeah, he definitely.
Is that what it was? Was he in MMA?
Yeah, yep. He had done some training and had a couple pro fights.
That's so exactly. Was he good or what was he?
If he was any good, he wouldn't have went to wrestling.
He never fought in UFC or anything.
Well, because there was actually money in wrestling at the time.
Well, that's fair too, but.
But I think a lot of it too was him getting over on Angle, who
Olympic champion.
A lot of
Angle.
People thought would wrestle or would fight in MMA at some point in time that he was trying to prove that he was a badass.
Well, even in the back, you hear in the backstage stories about Angle acting like he's legit tough and a badass. And I mean, he probably is. He won gold heavyweight wrestling in the Olympics. I mean,
with a broken frickin' neck.
With a broken neck. Not any pussy can do that. So.
No. And. I mean, Angle's expecting him to wrestle him, and he puts him in a fucking armbar.
Right.
I mean, what would you do?
There's not a lot you can do when you're in that position either to roll out of when you don't know what's coming, so you're kind of just...
Yeah, if you don't have any jiu-jitsu defense, you don't even know how to get out of a Kimura. It's not an easy thing to do if you know how to get out of a Kimura.
That's not something that translates from your Greco-Roman wrestling, so
it's not a full Nelson?
Well, no, a lot of that's upper body stuff, so when you're in an arm lock... You don't know how to get out of that based off of your wrestling skill set.
Mm-hmm. But Angle's face after that, whenever Pooter gets off him, dude, there was a steamy dude right there if there ever was one.
I don't think he ever worked again, did he?
Yeah. In fact, Pooter won it.
Yeah, he did win Tough Enough that year. He did.
Did he?
Yep. Yeah. And he was in the Royal Rumble, in fact, that year. 04, maybe? 03? Somewhere in there.
Many moon ago.
That's a tough era. The other one, and just because of how shitty the whole night was when Ross had to announce Owen Hart's death.
Oh, man. Happened at Kansas City, just like Sean was talking about Kemper Arena earlier.
Boy, you know, that's funny. I didn't bring that up to him.
As soon as he said Kemper, sadly, every time I hear Kemper Arena now, from now to the day I die, I'll think that's the place
I
where Owen
Hart
I
bet you know
died.
The exact quote that Jim Ross used, though.
It's my... I can no.
Something,
I can.
This is not.
You
a,
lose that
this
bet,
is not
sir.
A story, folks. This is something along those lines.
The unfortunate duty of letting you know about. Oh man, and fucking watching Waller.
I was watching that night live. It was crazy. It's too surreal to even look back and actually have the memory, though. I mean, granted, it was 20 plus years ago, but when something like that's going on, you're just experiencing it. You're not trying to really.
No, I know.
It was
that's
pretty
as,
nuts.
That's as breaking kayfabe as you can get, basically.
And the worst way to have to break it.
Yeah. You can dissect it, but everybody's dissected it to death. Mm-hmm. But the ultimate question is always, should they have gone on with the show?
I think so. I mean, they did. I think they did. I think Owen Hart would have said go on with the show. That guy was from a wrestling family.
You think so?
I think so.
I don't know. They definitely did go on with the show, but, I mean, they had the spot in the ring where the boards were broken underneath the ring, and there was blood in that corner. And if you watch the Austin-Taker match at the end, you almost see Taker start to choke up because he looks over in that corner because he knows. And they obviously told him.
Right.
They said, hey, stay away from this corner. And you just see And I imagine they were probably pretty close.
So let me get a little info from you. You might know better than I would about how well Owen was liked in the backstage. Because for the last several years at that point in his career, he was the Blue Blazer. He was in the Nation of Domination, the Nugget. He wasn't really as a serious of a contender. You get what I mean?
Yeah, and he should have been.
Almost like a joke. He should have been. I agree. But was he well-liked in the backstage?
He's probably one of the most underutilized workers they've ever had.
Yeah, he's a Henning.
He was, for a while, he was Coco Beware Jr. What else
Coco
did he do?
Coco Beware Jr.
You remember the outfit
high
they
energy.
Had?
High energy, man.
Yeah. Didn't that not look like a Coco Beware freaking
well,
out? They wore
the same thing.
Oh, yeah.
The fucking baggy blue pants with the racing stripe, the black and white
flag.
Checkered.
Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah. Owen Hart, of all the guys, I've never heard anybody say a bad word about him.
Not,
out of anybody.
Not in one shoot. No, you're right.
Ever. Just jokester. The pranks those guys would pull.
We should do a show on wrestling pranks someday. That'd be a good topic.
Oh, God, he did. They did the one where, and Bret Hart told it at the Hall of Fame ceremony where he said Bret got a call in the room. He said it's Reg Park, and Stu's like, "Hey, is this Reg?" And he starts talking to him, and he's like, Lord. "If you wanted to try me, Reg, why didn't you try me?" He's sitting there getting all fucking stewed, and then he finally puts the phone down. And he goes, "That bastard Owen." It was fucking Owen screwing with him. And it was at WrestleMania New Jersey or something.
That's funny.
And then there's the one he did to Hacksaw Jim Duggan. Duggan's asking about where the gym is. He calls down to the desk, and Owen Hart's checking in. And the guy's like, "I don't know where the gym is." And he sees a bunch of guys, and Owen's like, "Yeah, give me the phone."
Because he knows it's got to be somebody.
And he gets on the phone. He says, "Why don't you get off your ass, you lazy bastard, and go find it?" And he leaves, and he comes down. He says, "If it was anybody, just tell him it was me, Jim Powers." Fucking great. But that's always the funny shit you hear about Owen. Dude had to be a little nuts. Of course, I imagine if you grow up in a wrestling family, you're a little different anyway, especially up in the North, Great White North.
The Great White North.
So
speaking of, well, no, this doesn't really apply. Never mind.
Well, I got a funny one.
Go for it.
The Shockmaster.
You mean the Glitter Stormtrooper?
The all-time funny.
That was fucking great. First of all, who thought that was an okay mask to wear?
That's what I was about to say. Who thought that was going to get over?
Ole Anderson? Don't know.
He was the one doing the voice, right?
Yes.
So you take a standard off-the-shelf Star Wars Stormtrooper helmet, spray it with glue and dip it in glitter.
That had to have been styrofoam. What is it, like a mold?
Plastic, just like your thing.
Oh, my God. Glittered.
Thing was awful.
You stand next to a TV with that on, and it automatically gets cable. It's true. Check it out. It's on the internet.
But the story is that they wanted to reinforce the wall he's breaking through, so they put the extra plywood down there, or an extra 2x4, and fucking Typhoon. Why can't I think of his name all
That's
of a
who
sudden?
Played him?
Was Fred Ottman. Yeah.
Tugboat?
Tugboat, Typhoon.
I did not know that.
Oh.
Wow.
And just eats it. And then you hear Davey Boy Smith. He fell flat on his arse. Flat on his arse.
That's fucking great. I did not know, though, that was Tugboat.
And yet Sid continues through with the promo. He doesn't stop. I know you hear guys go, "Oh, no. Oh, no." And then they come back from commercial, and the announcers are still laughing their asses off.
Was that the only time we saw the Shockmaster, more or less?
I think so.
How do you use a character that's that ruined from the very beginning?
He turned in to Fred Ottman as like a construction worker.
Did he?
But he would always like accidentally fall.
Well, that
because
was
he ended up in the War Games that year as Fred Ottman without, he just had a hard hat.
War Games, that was a great fucking pay-per-view.
That is a great
They pay-per-view. Will bring that back within 3 years, I have a feeling.
You think? Yep. They've had plenty of time.
You mean having that good an idea, you think they'll bring it back at least 30 years after it's gone?
They should.
Do us all a favor.
How about this one? Okay, do you remember when McMahon supposedly had died in an explosion in his limo?
Ooh.
Yeah, they cut that dead because of Benoit.
Exactly right. That was one time they had to break a story.
I forgot about that. It was supposed to be his funeral that night.
Right, but due to the whole Benoit thing, they had to basically come out and say, "Yeah, this is a work."
I forgot about that.
Yes, sir. That was a fucked up one.
That was bad news. Yeah, that was going to be the end of McMahon's character on TV. Luckily, he hasn't come back or anything.
Nah, good. He was overused.
I mean, what would have been that story? McMahon coming back from the dead?
The Undertaker did it.
I mean, who would have... I guess you could have said he faked his own death 5 years later or whatever they wanted to do, but my God, he's been
He likes to fake his death every decade.
Wrestled matches on WrestleMania. I mean, he would have been gone in 07. Really? Do us a favor. But anyway, looks like our hour's up.
We want to end it like this? I got so much more.
You got more? Well, let's go. Okay.
Booker T. The Booker T interview where he's coming for Hulk Hogan.
We're coming for you.
Yeah, N-word. We're coming for you, N-word. I don't want to say it on this family show that we don't cuss or anything bad on. But as soon as he's cutting this promo with Gene Okerlund, he's part of Harlem Heat at the time. He's got Sensational or Scary Sherry, whatever you want to call him, right behind him. He's cutting it real loose. He's hot on this promo. And he's like, Hulk Hogan, we're coming for you, ninja. And then as soon as he does it, his face is in his hands. And you can tell he's going, oh, no, man, what'd I just say? And Sherry, she's stifling a laugh, kind of rubbing him on the shoulder, letting him know it's okay.
Botch-a-mania.
It was fucking great. One of the funniest ones I'd seen.
What else you got?
What about the time Kofi Kingston, I forget who he's out in the ring with.
Orton, isn't it?
Triple H.
It's the time where he loses his accent.
Drops the Jamaican accent. Yeah.
He's going on and on and on, and then out of nowhere, Triple H is like, hey, are you supposed to have a Jamaican accent? He's been cutting this whole thing in straight English.
He said it to him that way?
Right in the ring, right on TV. It's fucking great.
It's brutal.
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 What about the time Heenan, fresh off of a back surgery, Pillman's having a match with Guerrero. And, you know, Pillman's crazy enough. He runs out of there. He gets knocked out of the ring or whatever. He tries to hide behind Bobby Heenan, who I guess he didn't know was still injured and trying to recover. And Heenan freaks the fuck out. He says, what the fuck are you doing? Basically on his microphone because he has a no-touch clause or something like that in his contract at the time.
It's great. What the fuck are you doing? And he just gets up and walks behind.
All right. Shawn Michaels being hit by batteries. You've had to hear that story.
Yes, that was at the pre-WrestleMania show.
Right, he gets.
Is that what happened to his eye?
No,
no, he just gets hit in the head with a battery. Somebody from the crowd threw, and he just leaves the ring. And says, "Fuck it, I'm out of here."
Yep, they're in Boston outside.
But McMahon, as I like to call him, forces him to go back and continue. Like 5 minutes later,
yeah,
show must go on. Show must go on.
That's nuts. He was a mess. Oof.
Let's see. Do I got any more?
Pilled up, drugged up.
I think that about covers all the bigger ones that I can think of. You guys got anything else?
No, that one with Michaels. I keep thinking back to Michaels, yeah. They were, because he was being such a bitch about dropping the title that weekend, he got hit with a
battery.
He's
always such a bitch.
I got one more.
Go ahead.
Dustin Rhodes, coming out after being Goldust for so many years on WWF television, comes to WCW with a new gimmick, 7. They'd been showing the vignettes on TV for weeks. And he comes out and just cuts a roasting-ass fucking promo against the people, the powers that be behind the scenes at WCW. Goes on and on about how the bullshit he had to put up for all these years was gold dust. Now they got him coming out doing some stupid gimmick like this, looking like Uncle Fester.
White face with a black cowboy hat.
It's, and a giant, Hellraiser-style duster.
Yeah.
Real freaky. And what I thought was great about that, researching this topic last week, and the first time I probably saw it live, but first time remembering it, he shits on the Goldust character for so bad, and then what does he do for the next 15 years?
The Goldust character.
Goldust. Just, that's what you get.
It was on purpose.
Get paid.
You think that whole thing?
Well, I'm sure they said, hey, come out and make this, say Goldust was a joke. Or
well, I'm sure they, yeah, that's true. Fair enough.
And tore it up. But
Medusa throwing away the title. Is that really kind of breaking? I guess kind of. And still in kayfabe, but breaking it.
Taboo is shit. I mean, wrestling taboo.
It's a shoot.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Shane Douglas doing the same thing with the old NWA belt.
Yeah. Oh, man, see? God dang it.
I mean, there's a lot. There's just so much shit.
Last one. Triple H consoling the fan. The fan he scared, like the little kid he scared.
Could you imagine being a kid and being pissed? I can't imagine how many times I got upset.
Kevin Owens just fucking took shit over ripping a kid's sign at a house show and saying, I'm not going to sign your autograph or something. The mom posted it online and raised a bunch of shit about it.
Same thing happened with Orton not signing an autograph
at a gym.
Why do you bother? And one, you should be happy. You've got a story.
I agree.
That Kevin Owens ripped my sign up as a kid.
Oh, I'm on the opposite side with you. I think, for instance, in Orton's case, and he's at the gym, somebody asking for an autograph, why not? Don't be a dickhead about it. You're not in character.
He said wait and he would do it in a little bit.
Oh, well, that's fine then.
Into the mic.
I don't know the whole, T.O. likes to do the show from the hallway.
Yeah, just leave.
It's we got minutes left and he's gone.
Let's wrap her up. We're going to wrap up the first half because we're down a horseman.
This has probably been my favorite show so far out of the two or three that we've done.
Dude, Wheelock. Unreal.
Brought it, didn't he? Big thanks to Sean for that.
That show he did with us back in...
it was a year or so ago.
Yeah, about that time. I knew there's a wealth of knowledge in that guy. Especially growing up in Kansas City, and if he lived through Central States Wrestling, which, woo, man, if there's, You know what? I never saw that brand of wrestling until it was really in its dying days. We would get Central States in this part. We got so much stuff here
Channel
in the
11
St.
or something.
Louis area. I wanted to say Channel 30, and I wanted to say it came on after the NWA main show.
Sure.
We would get like a really just a strange show. But I remember seeing Butch Reed, a couple other guys.
Blonde Butch Reed? Or,
No, that was the natural Butch Reed with fake hair. That's actually really
loved
smart,
it.
Really smart gimmick. But anyway, our thanks go out to Sean Wheelock.
For sure, that was awesome. I would love to have him back on again. In fact, if we can get rid of Tim.
Yeah, well, maybe he'd stay for the whole show.
Yeah, but we got a real problem with people staying the whole show. Sean left in half an hour. Tim's left. God knows when.
Again, Sean, if you watch this, thank you.
Thanks, buddy.
Can't thank you enough. That's our Breaking Kayfabe edition of the Three Horsemen show. We'll be back with part two. We're going to talk some current wrestling, and we'll see you on the other side.
Oh, don't forget to go to our website.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, we got to do that kind of shit. If you're going to buy some stuff from Amazon, go to our website, threehorsemanshow.com, thethreehorsemanshow.com.
Boom.
Click the little Amazon banner, and anything you buy on that session will go to directly support our show. Make sure you follow us on Twitter and Facebook and every other social media out there. They're all the same. Numeral 3 Horseman Show. You find us on any platform.
And we're on YouTube.
YouTube's same. We don't have a URL yet. But if you do YouTube at all, go and subscribe to us. We need 100 subscribers to get our URL. That's our goal right now.
That is our goal.
So help us out.
And this show ain't stopping, so.
Trying to think of if there's any other plugs I got to give here. Lineupmedia.fm. Check it out if you're in another podcast. We got a lot of good shows, so check it out.
Check out Big E's other show, The Surreal Talk.
Yeah, we talk about a lot of crazy conspiracy, paranormal, you name it. If it's weird, we talk it. SurrealTalkPodcast.com.
Boom.
Great show, guys. And T.O., thank you again, T.O.
Oh, it was fun.
We'll see you next time.
We will catch you on the other side. We're talking current wrestling next time. This was Breaking Kayfabe for Big E, T.O. We'll talk at you soon.
Today's show is presented by DaVinci Smart Drink. Order yours now at lineupmedia.fm/DaVinci. DaVinci, excite better thinking.
Need a mental boost? DaVinci Smart Drinks were designed with professional thinkers in mind. With key ingredients shown to improve cognitive function and increase mental energy, DaVinci Smart Drinks excite better thinking. Drink a DaVinci. Let it go to your head.
This podcast was a presentation of lightupmedia.fm.